Well, thank you for that generous applause. I think the only time I received a louder one was when it was announced from this pulpit that I was leaving. So it's good to be back again. And yes, I'm going to be up front with you. I am gloating this morning over the hockey game last night, being from Canada. When the American team... When the American team scored that tying goal with 24 seconds to go, I want you to know while you were all singing the doxology, I went into cardiac arrest. So it is good to be back here again and have this opportunity to share with you. As Dr. Kalaga announced right after chapel, I mean literally right after chapel, I am heading for Myrtle Beach. So will you receive the benediction? I am going to leave this place faster than Israel left Egypt. So, well, I want to start off this week on changing our name by reading a passage from the book of Genesis, chapter 16, most of which has nothing to do about this week. Maybe that's one reason why I settled on it. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can have a family through her." Abram agreed to what Sarai said. So after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife, and he slept with her and she conceived. When she knew she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. Then Sarai said to Abram, "You are responsible for the wrong I am suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows she is pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." "Your servant is in your hands," Abram said. "Do with her whatever you think best." What a cheesy response. Then Sarai mistreated Hagar so that Hagar fled from her. The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert, and it was the spring that's beside the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from? And where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress Sarai," she said. And the angel of the Lord said, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." And the angel added, "I will increase your descendants so that they will be too numerous to count." The angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are with child, and you will have a son. And you shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard of your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers." And she gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God who sees me. For she said, I have now seen the one who sees me. That is why the well was called Be'er Lahai Roi. It is still there between Kadesh and Bered. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. That's Genesis chapter 16. Three interesting characters in this story: Abram, Sarai, and Hagar. We know that Abram means exalted father. We know that Sarai means princess. What about Hagar? What does her name mean? Well, we're not sure. But if you change the second A in her name to an E and pronounce it Hagar rather than Hagar, her name means outsider, alien, person who doesn't belong, person who doesn't fit. I don't think we've had a lot of women students at Asbury, at least during my tenure, whose name was Hagar. We've had a lot of Rachels and Sarahs and Rebeccas and Ruths and Esthers and Abigails. But I don't remember ever in my class calling the name of Hagar Smith or Hagar Johnson or Jones. And I'd be awfully surprised if there is any woman in the audience this morning whose name is Hagar. Are there any? Yes, one at the back. No, I just made that up. I wanted to see how many of you up here at the front would fall for it and turn around and look. While I was teaching here, one of the things I did is I took 13 years to write a commentary on the book of Genesis. After that, I went into therapy. When I was speaking at a conference, a person aware that I had written that commentary said, "Who is your favorite character in the book of Genesis? After 13 years of total immersion, who is your favorite character?" I'm sure they expected me to say maybe somebody like Noah or Joseph or Abraham. I said, "No, my favorite character is Hagar." You've got to be joshing. No, I was not. Let me tell you some of the reasons why I made that particular answer. I've just very briefly scratched down several of them. Hagar is the first person in the Bible to whom that individual who is referred to and described as the angel of the Lord appeared to. Before that angel, whoever that angel is, appears to any man like Jacob or Moses, he appears first of all to Hagar. Second reason is this: Hagar is the first woman in the Bible to whom God makes a promise. Not to Sarah, not to Rachel, not to Rebecca, not even to Eve or to Mrs. Noah. But she is the first woman to whom God makes a promise. And when the angel speaks to her, he speaks in language that recalls how the angel spoke to Mary, that she was with child, and you shall have a son, and you shall call his name. Fill in the rest. A third reason is that Hagar is the only woman in the Bible, the entire Bible, whose encounter with God results in a special name being given to that particular location where it happened. That happens frequently with men, and Abraham called the name of that place, and Jacob called the name of that place, and Moses called the but and Hagar called the name of that place. Here's a fourth reason. The Hagar story in the book of Genesis is the only story that takes place in a wilderness. And in chapter part two of the story of Hagar, chapter 21, she encounters the angel again at a well, at a bush in the wilderness. And can you think of anybody else in the Old Testament who encountered God at a bush in the wilderness before it happened to Mr. Big, Moses? It happened to her. But perhaps the most interesting thing of all to me is that Hagar is the only person in the Bible who is allowed to confer upon God a new name. God's always naming people. But nobody ever gets to name God except Hagar. But I'm really interested this morning in verse 8 of chapter 16. The angel asked Hagar two questions. Question number one, where have you come from? Question number two, where are you going? And if you think about it, you'll quickly observe that she answered only the first of those two questions. Where have you come from? I'm running away from my mistress. Where are you going? Silence. I can think of two reasons why Hagar was not able to answer the second question. Answer number one, think of the circumstances in which this woman is at the moment. Number one, she's female. Number two, she's single. Number three, she's pregnant. Number four, she's without a place that she can call home. Number five, she more than likely has minimal vocational skills. Number six, people look upon her more as property than they do as a person. Something that can be called upon when needed, and easily disposed of when no longer needed. And number seven, unfortunately, her chief contribution is that she's able to get pregnant and bear a child. My descriptor for Hagar, which is admittedly crude, is this. I refer to her, unfortunately and regrettably, as a womb with legs. Put a person in that kind of circumstance where there's nothing that's going right, and you say to them, where are you going? Where are you going in life? I mean, drive into Lexington and talk to a bag lady who's pulling her life's belongings behind her in a shopping cart and say to her, lady, where you're going? She can't tell you. I think there's a second reason why she can't answer, where are you going? And it's the same reason that you and I cannot answer the question. How does anybody know where they're going? I mean, I think the seniors would agree that it's much easier to talk about the last 4 years of your life than it is about the next 4 years of your life. It's easier to talk about your past than it is to talk about your present or your future, because you've experienced one, but not the other. I've often sat in graduation ceremonies, and I've heard the speaker say something like this to the graduating students. You have your whole future ahead of you. You have your whole future in front of you. Now, the only thing I'll say about that is it's wrong. But other than that, it's not bad. Now, why do I say that's wrong? You have your whole future in front of you. Well, if something's in front of you, you can see it. Can't you? I think it's much more accurate to say, you have your whole future behind you, because you can't see it. You never can walk into the future. You can only back into the future, because it's behind you. You can't see it, nor can I. I think there's only one person in all of history who was able to answer both of those questions that the Lord's angel asked Hagar. Do you know who that person is? He answered both questions. It's Jesus. Listen to what Jesus said in John chapter 8, verse 14. And think of those two questions from Genesis 16. In John chapter 8, verse 14, Jesus said, I know where I came from, and I know where I am going. The only person, people, who's able with power and authority to answer both of those questions. Not even Abraham could answer those two questions. I like the spin that Hebrews 11, verse 8, puts upon Abraham's faith back in Genesis chapter 12. Hebrews 11, 8 gives it this spin. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, he obeyed and he went. And then this most interesting phrase, even though he did not know where he was going. I understand that many seniors, when they graduate from Asbury, adopt that as the verse of the day. I have no idea where I'm going. Now, I'd like to pick up those two questions and address them to Asbury. Asbury, where have you come from? And where are you going? Many of you, when you were younger, were probably involved in some kind of a 4-H club at your school. We do not have a 4-H club at Asbury. But I'll tell you what we do have. We have 4-H weeks. What are the 4-H weeks? Well, a couple of weeks ago, we had Holiness Week. That's one of them. Every other year, as we talk about our roots, sometime in one of the two semesters, we have a Heritage Week. And I know that this week has been called Asbury University Week, but I'm going to take the privilege of calling it Horizon Week. Oh, and by the way, the fourth one is Happiness Week. That's the week after finals. Now, I have a suspicion that here at Asbury, like Hagar, we're much better at answering the first question than we are the second question. We talk a lot about our roots, our history, our heritage, and I'm glad that we do. But I want to tell you this morning that Jesus taught a whale of a lot more about where he was going than he talked about from where he came. He taught more about his destiny than about his roots. And if you don't believe that, just sometime take a concordance and check up how often the word going occurs on the lips of Jesus, especially in the Gospel of John. Now, part of where Asbury is going involves a name change. Now, my understanding is that in the last 20 years or so, about 400 to 500 schools have, to a certain degree, changed their name. They've rebranded themselves. And about 100 of those schools in the last decade or two have changed their name from college to university. The ones that we would identify with at Asbury would be schools like Huntington College, which became Huntington University, or Marion College, which became Indiana Wesleyan University, or Eastern Baptist College, which became Eastern College, which became Eastern University. I'm believing more and more that Darwin had some of it right in evolution. Now, I think there's one reason why we can greet the name change with some degree of affirmation and excitement. And for this reason, class, I mean people. Every person who gets a new name in the Bible, every time someone is rebranded, it speaks of a great and beautiful and more wonderful day ahead. It's always positive. It's always optimistic. It's always hopeful. It's always encouraging and inspiring. Matter of fact, this is a little quiz. There's only one person in the Bible who gets a different name that's a step backwards rather than a step forward. Only one. It's always a step up. Only one time it's a step back. Anybody know who that is? I can't hear anyway, so. The only one I know is a step back. Remember the name of Ruth's mother-in-law? Said, "Don't call me Naomi," which means pleasant one, "but call me Mara, bitter one." But thank God that never lasted, because by the time you get to the fourth chapter, even Naomi is super mama. Now, for some reason, and some of us get somewhat uncomfortable with change. We find it kind of unpleasant. It's kind of like developing a cold sore on your wedding day. I guess you've heard 1,001 variations of how many of this does it take to change a light bulb. Here's one more that you may not have heard. How many church people does it take to change a light bulb? The answer, change? Back in the early 1800s, an English clergyman by the name of Henry Light wrote what used to be a very well-known song. It's called "Abide With Me." To most of you, I'm going to assume that that's not all that familiar. But I can tell you, and I think you will be delighted to know this, that Queen Elizabeth II, before she was Queen Elizabeth II, had it sung at her wedding. God bless her. And it was sung at the funeral of Mother Teresa. Near the end of, I think it's the second stanza, these two lines occur. "Change and decay in all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me." Well, there goes my senior recital. I think the clap means an encore. "O thou that changest not, abide with me." That portion was taken from Malachi chapter 3, verse 6. "I, the Lord, do not change. O thou that changest not." Let me tell you, Malachi 3:6 is in the Bible to describe God. It's not in the Bible to describe Asbury. Or Hebrews chapter 13, verse 8. "Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever." Jesus, yes. Asbury, no. Now, why do schools change their name? Well, there's a bunch of reasons, aren't there? Some schools become a co-ed school. Some change their name because of a major gift from a donor. Imagine if our new name was Hamilton U. Or Or maybe it's more prestigious. Or maybe it has something to do with marketing, maybe drawing more students, or maybe a different direction in which the school is going. Now, we all know that there's no change without risk. Let me mention three risks that go with change when it comes to an educational institution, none of which I believe Asbury will fall prey to. First risk is that we might shift our significance from the point of our students and our faculty and our mission and our purpose to our label. Second risk is that going from a college to a university may produce a mishmash and a proliferation of academic programs, but with no coherence that ties them all together. That's what you get at UK. There's no coherence. Thirdly, and I borrow this line from John Anthony Chardy, an American poet of the last century, who said, "A university is what a college becomes when the faculty lose interest in their students." Think about that one. A college, a university is what a college becomes when the faculty begin to lose interest in their students. I assume they get more interest in their projects. But I don't think, by God's grace, that we will fall into any of those traps. I am excited about this place. I am as excited about it as when I was getting paid. I'm bullish on Asbury. And the reason is because not only do I believe that the Lord has the world in his hand, but I believe he has this school in his hand. And I believe he has you in his hand. And I'm excited about that. And I'm excited to get out of here. God bless you all. Amen.